welcome to the inaugural opening day, I guess you might want to say, episode of the Spitter podcast, the Spitter.com podcast. So these are from the weirdos that brought you formerly bugsandcranks.com. We're really excited to be rebranding ourselves and reimagining, I think, ourselves on the new site, the Spitter.com. It's going to be a lot of the same crazy baseball wackiness and commentary and silliness, but with a whole kind of new twist on it, I think you could say. So this is going to be a podcast component, I think. We have some really exciting ideas about what we want to do with it. Definitely some interviews with writers on the site, talking about teams and issues and all sorts of other fun things. Maybe we'll do some essays on here, but excited to add podcasts to mediums by which we can express our baseball thoughts. So welcome, glad to have you along for the ride. I'm Andy Smith, and joining me, I think it's pretty fitting for this inaugural podcast episode, is the Spitter.com's managing editor, skipper, Sherpa, I guess you could say all things. It's Patrick Smith, no relation, but Patrick Smith.
Smitty, somehow,
man. Yeah.
Somehow we're not related,
right? Yeah. At least that we know of. I'm sure, you know, in the old country, at some point we're probably
that's true. Relative. Western Pennsylvania roots don't run that
exactly.
Deep.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. There's no way we're not blood at some point. So, how are you tonight, man?
I am doing great. Thank you, Andy. It's exciting. I mean, we've been talking podcasts for a long time, and it's just nothing. It's something we never really pulled the trigger on, and I'm thrilled that you seem to know how to do it.
Well, I guess we'll let the people be the judge of that, right? Let's should wait more than 3 minutes before we declare right. Things like knowing how to do it. I can at least fake it to the point that that we can attempt to put this together. So.
If you insist.
Right. Well, good. So, you know, I kind of alluded to this in the intro, but perhaps as managing editor or skipper or Sherpa or all of those things, you could maybe explain a little bit at first kind of what bugsandcranks.com as the forefather to the spitter.com was, and maybe how you kind of became involved with it.
Yeah, well, you know, it was sort of an oddball baseball site that we founded, I guess, in 1906. No, it was in 2006, and I mean, I just discovered it, and it was I think it was a really kind of a genius idea that Jesse Pugh had, the guy who founded it, and the idea was that every team it was like a long form internet. It's a long form website or blog. Where every team would have a writer, and that writer would, you know, recap the night, not recap so much the night, you know, the night before games, because you can get that in the newspaper, but bring sort of a fan and writer perspective to each team and sort of the goings on and, you know, something a little bit beyond balls and strikes. We never made it to, you know, having quite enough writers, you know, a writer for every team. I think in our heyday, we came pretty close.
But, yeah. Although I will say, I almost feel like when we had it almost hit critical mass that I think it was almost too many voices at one point, or it felt to me like the closer we got to 30 in some ways, it was better when it was like 12, 13, 14. We really were. Maybe that's just because that's when the site was kind of at its peak. But yeah.
I think you're right. I mean, I think you're right. And that's also why we wound up doing sort of the 2.0 version of it, which was to maybe abandon the one team, one writer idea and just have about a dozen writers who could, you know, opine on their own favorite teams, but also keep an eye on just baseball in general. And that's kind of where we've been for the last few years. We've just had a stable of about a dozen writers. And the cool thing, I guess the two sides of the coin, double-edged sword, whatever sort of sad metaphor you want to use for that, is that, you know, that the guys and women have all been able to post their own thoughts whenever they wanted, right? And so that's kind of interesting, but it also is a little sometimes dangerous, because, you know, if there's not a lot of editorial oversight, you know, some of the stuff might be more interesting than other, frankly, you know.
No, on the internet, never. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So what we're hoping for now, I think, is to be a little, and curated is a buzzword, I think, on the internet.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, definitely. That could get a hashtag, like hashtag curated, you know, hashtag yeah. brand, like all those things.
Yeah, we could start that now. But
right.
But yeah, we're hoping to be a little bit more, a little bit, have a little more editorial oversight and to sort of, you know, curate the site a little bit.
So the site you're referring to is thespitter.com, which is the child of Bugs and Cranks. It's from you and Brad Bortone, who was, I think, an original hire for Bugs and Cranks, original staffer.
As were you.
Yeah, I was, exactly. Yeah, I was one of the original five. I don't think there were a lot of competitors for the Pittsburgh Pirates job in you know, November 2006. It was a pretty bleak time, which we'll get into later as we discuss our respective favorite teams. Smitty is an Orioles fan, so we were probably in a pretty similar place when we came on board Bugs and Cranks. But so just as background, it, for those of you that don't know, Bugs and Cranks, I guess, went on hiatus sometime towards the end of the season. Is my timeline right on that?
It's about July. We really felt like, okay, it's time to retool this. We had lost some momentum, I think. And, you know, I think it's really, if you run a site like this, it's really easy to get winded. You get really, really jacked up around spring training. And then you just come firing out of the gates. And by the All-Star break, you know, everybody's kind of sucking wind. And I'm going like, come on, guys, you know, we need some stuff up on the site. And so, really, we just, you know, Brad and I both thought, like, all right, this is now a good opportunity to kind of, you know, turn off the lights for a little while and maybe, you know, retool and come up with some new ideas and so do some rebranding. So that's kind of where we are with the Spitter.
And is it, do you think there's going to be any specific changes? I mean, if there's like one, I don't know, maybe a couple things that you think people should look for on the site, is there anything in particular that you would say in regard to that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say in addition to editorial oversight, which would be a nice change of pace. Yeah, I mean, I think that editorial oversight and fully legal photographs.
I feel like fully legal photographs have been an issue since like day three of Bugs and Cranks. There are probably emails about. Do you remember there was a time when we were instructed to. Like, it was okay if you used a Google image search. Everybody, basically, like, the dirty secret is that, like, we had ideas of using Creative Commons and finding stuff, but the ability to find the photo that you wanted that matched your piece, or I don't know if this is your experience, but that I would write a piece and I'd work on it and I'd get it done. And then the last thing I wanted to do was search through these like Creative Commons sites to find the photo. It's like all creative energy I had in my free time had been used up writing this piece. And so I was like, fine, I'll just use a Google image search. But the story was that we were instructed to put captions on initially and that we thought that would get us around the whatever copyright laws for a low rent blog like us.
Yeah, the captions were photo credits.
So right, we're using photo credit stuff. But then there was an email that was like, stop putting credits on it, might get us into more trouble.
Yeah, it's just steal it and hope nobody knows.
Exactly, yeah, right. Which is pretty much like blogging in 2006 and probably not all that different in 2015. But in the event that it is, we're going to be more legal this time, which is good. So
yeah, we're going to do away with the, you know, no right clicks. It's going to be our that's our motto now.
Yeah, it's going to be on the banner, I think. So yeah. No right clicks since 2015.
Right.
But it's largely going to be the same writers, right?
A lot of the same, characters, you know, a lot of the really fun and talented writers that made Bugs and Cranks, really a pleasure to work on and I hope to read. But we have a couple of new folks coming in that we've recruited, Landon Evanson, our guy out in Minnesota, has sort of cast a wide net across Twitter, and he found a couple of really talented people. The guys who were behind Cespedes Family Barbecue. I don't know if you've seen that Twitter handle.
Oh, hey, that's fantastic! Yeah,
I know, it is a real get.
Yeah,
Oh, wait, now I seem to have activated my Siri here. Sorry about that.
Siri, that was... how's the spittergott.com going to do, right?
Yeah, right. I know, I should have listened to what
yeah,
she said.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, but no, so Cespedes Family Barbecue, which I love and I think is hysterically funny. And we have a couple more. That's two different guys, and I think they're in England right now. Huh. They're very young fellas.
Yeah, I think like college students, it's like when knowing their popularity and knowing how young they are, it made me feel very depressed. But that's in a good way. I suppose.
I've been there a long time, Andy. You used to make me feel that way. So join the club.
That's right. Well, I guess all is fair at this point. It all comes full circle eventually.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, here you go, Smitty. I mean, things that would have been incomprehensible to me in 2006. We started this a little bit late because I was getting instructions from my father-in-law on how to buy Bruce Springsteen tickets tomorrow. He's from Jersey and so is like required by law to like Bruce Springsteen. And I'm discovering now that when there's a tour announced, everybody in the it's all hands on deck. And anybody who's near a computer at the time the tickets go on sale has to log in and try to grab as many as they can for a designated show along the East Coast. So I was getting my instructions. Family responsibilities. These are what changes in a decade. So
that's very true. And yeah. I mean, there are so many things there that you wouldn't have fathomed having a father-in-law. You know
for
what
starters,
I mean?
Caring about Bruce Springsteen would be another one. But
right. Well, is he playing in Washington? Is that the
so Washington, Philadelphia? He's playing in Pittsburgh. He's playing in New York. So. And I think I've been assigned Pittsburgh and D.C. as my designated areas. But, yeah.
Well, I wish you luck for the show at the Stanley Theater.
There you go. Yeah, exactly. We'll keep everyone posted. I'm sure you're riveted to this discussion. But yeah. Well, anyway, that's a great get. So we got the Cespedes Family Barbecue guys. And
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a couple – there's a guy who's a – oh, you know, I don't want to blow the surprise. This is too much, but –
yeah,
we have a Kansas City guy who's really super funny.
Awesome.
And also a very good writer. Yeah. So I mean, I think you know we're gonna go with I don't want to say like magazine length pieces. I mean, I don't think there's a whole lot of patience for that. But you know, definitely longer than like you know Facebook and Twitter type you know social media things. I mean, most of our guys are. Most of our writers identify themselves as writers, and so you know we like baseball and we like writing and we like writing about baseball. So, you know, 500-600 word pieces are going to be kind of the norm, I think, on Bugs and Cranks.
Yeah, I mean, I feel
like on the spitter. Ooh, I said it.
I didn't catch you there either on thespitter.com. But you know, I think that if I could, I don't know, distill kind of what. The spirit of Bugs and Cranks was, I think it was really those 500 and 600 word pieces. And I think that when we came about in, I don't know, 2006, that was really kind of the norm or much more the what was expected, especially pre-Twitter, I think. I don't know, it was pre-even Facebook walls in some ways. But anyway, I feel like we've always kind of kept that ethos alive. And maybe it's a bit more of challenging to produce content that's good and I think that the changes we're making to the editorial process will mean that you know maybe you don't see the volume of posts or that you I don't even want to say that I guess I would just say that I think that the changes we're putting in place and kind of the way that what's expected about online content and writing has kind of come full circle recently I think the changes are really gonna make us stand out again and the spirit of Bugs and Cranks will live on in the spitter.com and it should be lots of good stuff.
I think so too. And I think that, you know, I mean, we were born before Grantland and we lived longer than Grantland.
hear that, Bill Simmons? Right.
Yeah. But you know, I think everybody, all of us really liked Grantland and admired it. And it was really, it was an eye opener that there was a real, audience for, you know, for that kind of writing, you know, I mean, because everybody told us, no, you guys are nuts to nobody wants to read anything on the internet. And that's, I mean, we found that really wasn't true, you know, with our site and with, you know, other places like Grantland and even, you know, not so much Deadspin, but
SB Nation long form, you know, I think they certainly do game threads and stuff, but there's a lot of good long form stuff there. And
yeah.
There's definitely a place for it, I think. And
I think so too.
Yeah. So, all right. So I actually think that's a good transition to what else we wanted to do on this inaugural show, which is kind of give something of a proof of concept to what we're just talking about right there, which is how we think about baseball and the way we approach it, both as analysts or commentators or fans, I guess. So Smitty is a Baltimore Orioles fan, as we kind of alluded to when describing we rooted for teams that sucked and had no hope in 2006. So I thought we could talk about the Orioles a little bit here, and, you know, the team kind of in general, but also a little bit about your experience as a fan. You know, I think they're having a kind of an interesting place this offseason, so it's a nice, rich topic. I'm legitimately curious to get some perspective from someone who follows them pretty closely, so that should be fun. But I think my first question is just kind of, what is your, for everybody, what is your background as an Orioles fan? You're not initially from Baltimore, correct?
Right. No, I live in the city now, but we've been here for a long time, but I moved here in high school. I grew up a Pirates fan.
Yeah.
Born in Johnstown.
Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. And, you know, grew up a Pirates fan and grew up in the South, though. So I was a Pirates and a Braves fan. I moved here in high school and just adopted the Orioles. You know, they were fairly fresh off the 83 World Championship. And thought, wow, this will be a pretty easy team to root for, you know, and then they slid into the crapper for the next however many years. But I don't know, you know. I mean, I just felt so. I grew up in Raleigh, and it, you know, Raleigh's a great town, but there's no baseball there. They have minor league baseball now, way out in the country in like Zebulon, but not in Raleigh. So. It felt really great to live in a big league town and to go to Memorial Stadium and just to decide, you know, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, like, hey, I think I want to go down to the ball game tonight. And like, oh man. I mean, I just loved hanging around the stadium and being there and, you know, being there when there were 8,000 fans in the ballpark and putting your feet on the seat in front of you and drinking beer. And I when I was in college, I got a job as on the grounds crew.
Two things I want to kind of jump in quickly and say. I think it's really interesting what you're describing. We're talking about, I guess, fandom. You know, in the mid '80s, there's not the MLB package on TV. There's not the internet. You're not able to. You know, I feel like if someone today moved from Johnstown to Raleigh, it'd be pretty easy for them to stay engaged on the Pirates. It'd be a lot easier than it was back then. And so what you're describing is kind of, you know, a fan of the Pirates, but then you're in Raleigh and you're disconnected in a lot of ways from any professional baseball. And so I can imagine the appeal you must have felt to be suddenly in a big league town where the Orioles are a big deal. I mean, they were kind of the only show in town, right? I mean, I guess the Colts were gone at that point, and it must have been really fun to take in that way.
It was fun, and and growing up in Raleigh, if I wanted to listen to them, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about this today, you know, except like before the Braves started broadcasting every game that they played, on every television across the country, you know, there was one game on television a week, and it was at 1 o'clock on Saturday. It was the NBC game of the week, and it would be Joe Garagiola and Tony Kubek. You know, and it would be the Cubs and the Pirates, or it would be, you know, the Orioles and the Yankees or something. And that was it. I mean, you had to make sure you were home at 1 o'clock on Saturday, because otherwise you wouldn't see a ball game all week. Raleigh's 500 miles from Pittsburgh, but, you know, on a clear night, I could pull in KDKA and listen to the Pirates.
Was that the end? That was sort of the end of Bob Prince, right? That would have been.
No, it was Lanny.
Lanny Fritteri. Man, that's what I grew up with. That's funny. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. No doubt about it.
It was Lanny and I forget who the other guy was. It was Milo and Lanny.
Milo and Lanny. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, it wasn't. I'm not quite old enough for Bob Prince. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, you know, when 1990 is when I really got into baseball, and he was long gone by that point. So my knowledge of kind of when he stops and when Lanny begins is somewhat limited. But that's cool. And it's funny that, you know, I'm sure you and I could name all Lanny-isms and we could bond over like random tidbits. That's great about baseball. You know, it's like these little quirks that you find commonalities with. But
yes, yeah.
So all right, so you arrive in Baltimore on right after the '83 World Series. Now I know that by the late '80s it's pretty bleak. Was it a slow decline for the Orioles into let's say the '88 season? But yeah,
it was kind of like they say, you know, if you put a frog in a pot and you boil him, you mm-hmm. know, he doesn't really notice it. You know, if you put it in real hot water, he notices it. But it was sort of the way it was for the Orioles, because, you know, you just kind of slowly realize that it was after about 4 years, you go like, oh my God, this team stinks. You know?
Right.
They went from, you know, world champs, and then they thought, you know, maybe let's bring Earl Weaver back, and that was a terrible idea. You know,
it never works, right? It never works. Yeah,
it just doesn't work. Yeah. And, you know, and so just, you know, slowly, they just, you know, one day we all woke up and thought, "Oh my God, look at this roster! This says there's no talent." And that was, you know, that was the year I got the job on the grounds crew.
So you were on the grounds crew in 88. That was that you mentioned that, or
yeah,
wow,
yeah,
okay. So what was that like? Yeah.
I was a junior. I was a junior in college, I think, at Towson State, and I thought I had just transferred here because I went to school somewhere else, and I just transferred to Towson State, and somebody told me, "Hey, they're hiring on the grounds crew at Memorial Stadium." And I thought, "Oh, that's ridiculous! Like everybody in the entire city wants that job. You know, how could I possibly compete?" For the with the throngs of fans who want to be on the field every day, and I got the bus down to the ballpark and applied for the job. And the guy, I didn't even finish the application. The guy was like, "Okay, you're hired." I was like, "Really?" He said, "Oh God, nobody wants this terrible fucking job. It's awful."
And you took it anyway. Yeah.
Oh, took it anyway. Uh-huh. It was $3.35 an hour and a season ticket. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if you remember at Memorial Stadium, the grounds crew guys sat down the third base line where the tomato plants were.
Oh, man.
Where Earl Weaver planted tomato plants. And it was just – I mean, we sat right between the third baseman and the left fielder, right on the field. You know what I mean? And
That's crazy.
It was so great to watch baseball from that
ground. So I was going to say, so when I was after college, I worked – very peripherally in media relations and basketball. And at the point I got to sit at the scorer's table for a Cavaliers Celtics preseason game. And seeing, like, you know, Ray Allen shoot threes up close, or just the athleticism on these guys is just, just blew my totally new appreciation for the sport. So I'm wondering if you had that same experience when you got to watch 81 games from that vantage point.
I had that exact experience. You know, every time, and I mean, I saw, I was in the ballpark the night that there's a really iconic video clip of Bo Jackson climbing the wall at Memorial Stadium to bring back a home run. And he doesn't like jump up and like reach over the wall. Mm-hmm. He runs straight up it. He
scales the wall, right? Yeah.
He scales the wall and rips the fabric with his spikes and brings it back. And I was there that night. It
oh
was
my
like,
God.
I wow. saw it. I was probably 30 yards from it. And
did it look real in person? Like, did you think this was going to happen, or did it just kind of happen? And
it was like, that ball's gone. I forget who hit it, but mm-hmm. you're like, oh, that ball's way out of here. And then you're like, oh no. Oh my God. Yeah. I think he's, you know, it looks like Jackson's got a beat on it now. It's like, he's climbed up the wall to get it. Yeah, I'll just never forget it. It was just like a superhuman trick.
Yeah.
And then even like the more, you know, the more sort of routine stuff, like, I'm trying to remember, oh man, it was like Brooke Jacoby for Cleveland. He was playing left. And, you know, there was a foul ball. It was just a regular, you know, foul ball that you never think about. But he had been shaded towards center field, and so he was sprinting as hard as he could. And he was running right at the grounds crew pit. And, like, right at the warning track, he goes down and slides and makes a nice catch. And, you know, on TV, you know, probably the announcers would have said, "That's a tremendous catch by Jacoby," you know, but wouldn't go nuts over it. But when it happens right in front of you,
yeah.
and there's this superhuman athlete, you're like, God damn, that's it's
yeah.
Like,
that's the thing I bet you'd appreciate is just how hard it is to make what we've come to accept as routine look routine. You know how what goes into it. I think
it's even throwing, even warming up, even watching them warm up,
mm-hmm.
like you know, like the outfielders throw in between innings, you know what I mean? To throw a ball from the left field to center on a hard straight line, that's hard to do. That's really hard.
Oh my
and
God,
you and yeah. I can't do it. I still play in the old men's league and we throw balloons at each other. it's just astonishing when you're able to see things up close. Like if you ever get a chance to sit close to the ball field, take the chance, do it, because it's just a whole other ball game than like sitting in the nosebleeds. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's so cool to get to see what these guys make look so easy. You know.
So, I guess in addition to just appreciating how incredible the game is up close, I'm also more interested in what it was like to be in the stadium every night for a team that starts 0-21 and basically has no hope by the end of the first month. I mean, is it? I don't know. In some ways, it's almost like it's a great story, right?
It was a great story, and it was like, I mean, it was just dismal. I mean, they were just awful. They, you know, there were a couple extra inning games maybe that they might have had a chance, but mostly they were just. They just were overmatched. And I remember they started with, like, Kansas City and Milwaukee and teams that were really good in those years. And it was just like, forget it, you know. But as the streak grew, you know, and they'd go out of town for a little while, you know, lose a couple.
right, like right, get swept and then, yeah.
Get swept in Texas and, you know, somewhere else. And then they'd come back and, you know, there'd be – remember there were commercials on the radio, hey, cheer on the Birds, and they come back to town, and people were like, ah, they stink, why would I bother? But then as it got, you know, as it got bigger and bigger, you know, there were like radio stunts in town, like a guy, you know, a guy sat on the roof of the, I forget where he was, but some morning DJ goofball sat on the roof of something or other. Oh, it was on the air for...
Yeah, a billboard or something, if I remember.
Yeah, that's right? What it was.
Yeah, right, okay. Yeah,
but it was just some like stupid stunt, you know.
Oh, man.
And, but, you know, it got a lot of attention. And then, but, you know, I remember like I remember before I went to before I went to the ballpark one night, you know, I was like checking out like the afternoon news or something and, you know, just seeing, you know, the national, you know, NBC News saying, well, the Baltimore Orioles have still not won a game 3 weeks into the season. Like, oh, God, is that possible? So, yeah, I mean, it was weird. And then, of course, you know, when they came, you know, they came back after, I forget how many they'd lost, but it was they had fantastic fans night. Like, they'd gotten smoked and,
right,
ridiculous on a road trip, and the first game back from the road trip was like fantastic fans night, and there were 55,000 people in Memorial Stadium. You know, it was just like they just, you know, they I mean, you know, the Baltimore loves the Orioles.
I was going to say, so did the city kind of end up embracing this? I mean, I guess if you're only a couple years removed from a World Series, it's not like. You might, if this were in, you know, year 20 of some ridiculous losing streak or, you know, it's, I feel like you maybe have a little more capital at least. And
that's a really good point.
Yeah. And as we were discussing, you know, they were really the only show in town. Right. And so it's a different kind of relationship, I think, with the team when they're the lone professional franchise.
That's very true. That's very true. And the taste in everybody's mouth after the Colts left. So this was 4 years after the Colts left, and people were still totally freaked out about it and like couldn't get their heads around like, oh my God, there are no Baltimore Colts. And so it was a little bit of like, you know, we really kind of have to embrace this team, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll say though, believe me, you know, they didn't set any attendance records that year.
That would be something. Boy, that would really that would be really something if they'd you know, drawn. Yeah.
That one night was a very special night and a great, great crowd. But, you know, the next night there were 3,500.
But it wasn't so fantastic. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, but it was really, I mean, it did get to be fun, and the players are totally anonymous. I mean, except for Eddie Murray and Cal Ripken were on that team. But otherwise, you know, like Ken Gerhart and Jeff Stone and all these like guys that just never made the majors. And they were kind of nice and humble fellows. They were kind of cool and used to hang around with the grounds crew and talk about, you know, professional wrestling and stuff.
Yeah, that's cool.
We liked them. You know what I mean? Just our guys.
So am I remembering correctly too that then 88 isn't so great, but 89 they kind of turned the corner, right? There was a kind of a magical run to almost the postseason at that point.
Yeah, you're right, Andy. And they and I was on that grounds crew too. So that was the 2 years I was on, was 88 and 89, okay, which was really fantastic. Yeah, they almost won the division the next year.
I guess you see turnarounds like that in baseball. I mean, like, you know, think about the Astros who were so terrible for a number of years and then pretty terrible in 2014, but then, you know, led the division for a number of days this year. But I feel like you saw that coming. You know, there was a clear controlled demolition to why they were so awful and a stockpiling of prospects. And maybe this year the Astros arrived a little ahead of schedule, but people kind of were like, okay, yeah, you know, this eventually was the plan. But, you know, to go from starting 0-21 and just being abysmal to almost making – and I guess, you know, luck plays a role, but it feels like that's kind of a staple of baseball almost that you don't see as much anymore in this kind of bigger money, better farm systems, very shrewd front office kind of situation we're in.
Yeah, it feels like it feels like it's harder to surprise people.
Right.
And that's a good point about the Astros. You know, I wonder what Bo Porter would think. Wonder what Bo Porter thinks of the Astros. You know what I mean? He thinks, that's my team.
Right, exactly. Well, so, you know, sadly, it's not Bo, but yeah.
I taught Jose Altuve everything he knows.
Right, exactly. Yeah, right, yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, no, I mean, so in 88, you know, I mean, we had, I mean, the thing that was, I mean, that was the year that was the year that Cal Ripken Sr. got fired. And, you know, Sr. was the manager. And Cal and Billy were both on the team, so it was a big deal that the Ripkins, you know.
Yeah, and I know that Billy and Cal were raised in the Baltimore area. Was Cal Senior from there too, or did he just come there when, you know, the team? Yeah,
I think he is from here. Yeah, okay. he's from Hartford. They're all from Hartford County. Which is up 95 a piece from the city, and but you know, Cal Senior was this, you know. He was a lifer, and you know, managed in you know, Aberdeen, South or North Dakota, I forget. You know, and managed all over the Orioles farm system when they used to have like Class D. all the teams had like 10 farm teams, so he managed all over those all over the country for them. But yeah, Cal and Billy grew up in Aberdeen, Aberdeen, Maryland. And and so he was, you know, Senior was the manager and got canned about like maybe, I don't know, I forget, not long into the season, maybe a week and a half or something. And you know, if you listen to Cal talk, you know, even now, he still is mad about that. I mean, they replaced his dad with Frank Robinson. Ooh. And you know, I think Cal thought his dad didn't get a fair shake and all that kind of stuff. I think the Orioles, that, you know, maybe the Orioles kind of did him wrong after he put so many years of service in for the team. But, like, I interviewed Cal for Bugs and Cranks last, or maybe the season before last. And, you know, I kind of asked him about his dad. And he was a little bit like, I mean, I don't know. I just got the vibe that he was still kind of hot about it.
There's still something there. Yeah. I mean, it's your father, I guess. It makes sense. And fatherly, well, I don't know. I don't want to judge Frank Robinson too harshly from afar. But my impression is it would be a very different experience to go from being managed by your old man to being managed by Frank Robinson.
Yeah, I think they were both amazingly total hard asses.
Right.
And, you know, the first thing Frank Robinson did was get rid of Curt Schilling, because he thought he wasn't serious.
Well, I would say that he was probably right that he wasn't serious, or
good.
Yeah, right. Yeah. but you know, I would say that perhaps from a personnel standpoint, that might have been a mistake.
Yeah, I think that was among the mistakes.
Yeah.
Kurt Schilling showed up in Baltimore with or he showed up in the clubhouse with pink hair and an earring.
Oh, I'm sure Frank Robinson loved that. Yeah,
exactly. That's not really Frank's style.
No, not so much. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the end of that.
So I mean, I think what's interesting, this was kind of a larger point that I wanted to talk to you about. But I mean, I think 88 and 89 are kind of a really nice microcosm of this. But it seems to me that, you know, there's really kind of been very little in between for the Orioles, maybe since like the 83 World Series, that they've been, I mean, they've been really good kind of as they were in the late 70s, early 80s. I mean, even starting in the 60s. And then there was that very kind of steep fall off in the late 80s. And then, you know, they're pretty good at Camden Yards and then this whole losing streak. And then the last 4 years, they've been contenders. And so, I don't know, is my assessment kind of correct that there are some really extreme peaks and valleys, maybe more so than rooting for other teams that you might say that kind of define being an Orioles fan?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that they're mostly valleys and deep ones because, you know, there have been some really, really terrible years. But yeah, I think so. They seem streakier than most teams. They, you know, the teams that they were you know, the teams that I wrote about for Bugs and Cranks for the Orioles were just I think I started in 2007 with Bugs, and the Orioles weren't just bad; they were like weird bad. You know what I mean?
There's bad, and then there's weird bad. Yeah,
yeah, they were weird. Like they had, I mean, they were juiced.
Sammy Sosa. Like basically, like the Mitchell report was like, you know, 60% of their starting lineup or something. So
exactly the Mitchell report, which we all wrote about at length. But the Mitchell report was like the Orioles roster.
It was the 2007 Orioles yearbook. Yeah, right.
It was. It was, and you think like, come on, Larry Bigby. Who cares?
You'd Larry, like to think if you're rooting for a juicer to at least produce some wins and some exciting moments, but Larry Bigby didn't really help with either. Yeah.
No, there seemed to be only a couple kinds of Orioles that they were, and they were all, you know, they were all juiced, but they, you know, they were either like marginal guys like Larry Bigby, who, you know, you think, please, or they were guys like David Segee, who seemed to just like go completely anabolically crazy and, you know, pump themselves up and, you know, hit, I don't know, 30 homers or something. And the GM goes bananas and signs them to a 4-year deal for a bazillion. And then they completely collapse like before the ink is dry.
Right.
You know what I mean? All of their joints.
Yeah, they go off. So they cycle off because now they've gotten paid, and so you know what's the.
I don't know if they cycle off.
I don't want to get sued on our first podcast.
No, I don't either. Yeah. But I think, you know, when they're all their biceps roll up like window shades, like detached from their joints,
again, also not conducive to being a successful big leaguer. Who knew?
No, that's correct.
And you know, the thing about that era is that the AL East was just brutal. I mean, it was so good. You had, you know, the Yankees and Red Sox at the kind of the height of their ESPN fetishized rivalry. You had the Rays starting to turn a corner with some better leadership. And, you know, the Blue Jays, you know, I remember reading kind of when the Blue Jays broke through this year that a lot of those teams that they had in the mid-2000s, like if you look at their record against other divisions, I think even the Orioles to an extent, if you look at how they did against teams outside the AL East, pretty good, probably, you know, 500-ish. But you know, they just had the misfortune of playing in this division with like maybe the three best teams in baseball at some points. And so that's its whole other component to all of this.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think, you know, in Baltimore, I mean, people said many times, how come we can't play in the American League West? You know, I mean, it was so hard to beat these teams that, you know, and I mean, economics have changed a lot in not a lot of time. You know, the TV revenue and stuff and you know, teams that start their own TV networks and stuff, you know, that seems to have changed a lot of playing fields. I mean, you and I, you and I, you know, cried many tears over, you know, the small market, you know, issue.
It was basically like, well, if I don't have anything to write about, I can always find a new way to complain about being a small market fan this week. So
that's true. Yeah. And damn it, we did it very well.
Exactly. Darned if we didn't make it sound compelling each time. So yeah, at least we think so. But
Well, so, you know, that's, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't exactly know the economics of how it all changed, but, you know, they're your world champion Kansas City Royals.
Right, right. I mean, that, we talk about another thing that would have been, you know, incomprehensible when the site started. But, I would love to hear your thoughts on Peter Angelos. And I realize that asking you at this point in the podcast, when we don't want to go all night, is probably problematic, because I my understanding is that there's a lot to unpack there. But, you know, I remember when I first became aware of baseball's economic discrepancies, which is, you know, like early 90s, when, as a Pirates fan, when Bonds leaves, when Drayback leaves, and the Pirates don't have the money to replace them. One of the teams that really kind of made me jealous was the Orioles, who were signing these, you know, Rafael Palmeiro and Robbie Alomar, and, you know, trading for Bobby Bonilla a couple years later. And so, you know, they had a new ballpark, and it seemed like Angelos was really kind of an owner that was going to spend with the big boys. And then all of a sudden that just kind of stopped. And I've heard that maybe the Albert Bell contract was the impetus, but I'm curious to know kind of what you think the story is there.
Well, I mean, it is a lot to unpack. I mean, I think that he's been, we've seen a lot of different Peter Angeloses, in the however many years it's been. I guess it was 1990. I want to say 92 or 93 that he bought the team. Maybe, I don't know. I should look that up before I say it. But but yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, the Albert Bell thing. You know, there were big budget team, and then suddenly they did seem to stop spending money. You know, he's a complex guy, and he's you know, a lot of people really, really do, you know, hate the guy with a passion. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, he can be pretty hateable. But at the moment, you know, it seems that he seems to have understood that he doesn't need to, you know, make the trades himself. And he doesn't need to, you know, kind of, he just needs to bring the right people in and let them do their jobs. I wish I had better insight in it, but it's just like,
does, right? I mean, that's kind of the impression I get, is that he's kind of whatever you want to make him to be. That if you want to argue that he's, you know, a penny pincher but still too hands on, that there are some evidence for that. If you want to argue that he's, you know, just doing what he can and really wants to win and cares about Baltimore, that you can argue that. And it's really not cut and dried. And I feel like that he's kind of whatever you can make of him, which makes him really hard to summarize in 2 minutes.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, and I think it's also easy to forget that, and I don't want to sound like an apologist, but it's easy to forget that, you know, he was kind of the only owner who did right by, you know, the union.
Yeah, this is key. Can you please enlighten us? Like, it sounds like you're going to, because this, I think,
well,
is really interesting.
I hope so. Now, I hope it's been a while and I didn't prepare, but
no, it's okay.
It's, no, I mean, you know, when the rest of baseball was trying to, the rest of the baseball owners and the commissioner were trying to break the union, Peter Angelos refused to field replacement teams. He just, you know, and that has a lot to do with his background. I mean, Angelos is he made his money with asbestos and tobacco. You know what I mean?
Right.
Mostly asbestos, and
lawsuit representing class action suits. Right. Not working
make
for
his
the company
selling asbestos.
Right. Yeah. Just a key distinction there. Yeah.
It's
right.
A great industry in that.
It was a growth industry in the 60s. But yeah. Right.
He represented people who. He represented lawsuits. I mean, he filed lawsuits on behalf of people who you know, got sick and died because of asbestos. And so, I mean, he's very much an East Baltimore guy. You know, he's a neighborhood guy. There's a lot. There's just kind of a lot. And he's a you know, very, very strong Democrat. I think he was on the city council back in the early 70s. Yeah, I mean, he's shown, you know, he's definitely a labor guy. He usually falls on the side of labor and labor management problems. So, you know, I mean, I think that the Players Association, I shouldn't call it a union because that bugs me too. It's a right. Players. It's not like the Amalgamated Baseball Union, you know.
Right.
But they owe an awful lot to Peter Angelos for sort of standing up for him. And you know, he's the first guy who took a team to Cuba. You know, I mean, there's a lot of weird stuff that he did that you know, I think it can get lost in the really easy demonization of Peter Angelos. I mean, I've demonized him as much as anybody in the terrible years, but you know, you also, I think, might have to tip your hat ultimately to the guy.
That's really interesting. So I guess that's a good jumping off point for that. The last, you know, 4 or 5 years of the Orioles have been pretty good. I guess, would you pin it with starting with the Showalter hire, or is it really later when the 2012 season when they kind of, again, I guess we just talked about how there weren't surprises, but if any team surprised, it was probably the 2012 Orioles and make this exciting playoff run.
Well, they sure surprised me. But, you know, I kind of think, and again, you know, a lot of people try to hoot me out of town when I say this, but you know, I kind of feel like the Andy McPhail years sort of set the table for this. You know, Buck Showalter has been absolutely transformative, and you know, I think he's the best manager in baseball. He's perfect for this team. He's perfect for this market. He's such a, you know, I mean, he's inspirational to the fans. I mean, he just can do no wrong here. But you know, Dan Duquette is the GM, and of course, he was about the fifth choice. You know, nobody wanted this job.
Was it because of Angelos ostensibly, or
it was because of Angelos, and it was also because of you know, the farm system didn't look too good. The prospects didn't look too good. People were still afraid of the Yankees in Boston. You know, it was just like, oh my God, that's a tall mountain. If I can get a job anywhere else, I mean, like, you know, people were turning these jobs down for Anaheim and Toronto and places like that. So yeah, I mean, finally they pulled Dan Duquette out of like mothballs. He'd been out of baseball for 10 years. He ran a summer camp. He was running a summer camp in Western Massachusetts, like renting canoes and stuff. And they brought him back.
I can't picture him as a camp counselor. Actually, I take that back. I sort of can in a lot of ways. Like
a crew cut.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a more antiquated camp counselor than one you might expect to see in, you know, 2011 or whatever he was doing it. But yeah. But there's definitely,
I could see him wearing like a white just undershirt, standing behind a desk, signing out canoes. You know,
sign here, please.
Yeah. I can really see that.
That's a pretty stark image, Smitty. I'll give you that one. Yeah,
New England accent.
Yeah, right.
But so he came, and I just, you know, there was all sorts of questions that, like, oh, how's he going to do with Showalter, and is Showalter going to hog all the glory like he wants, you know, like he did in Texas and in Arizona, but. It's just been a perfect. It seems to have been a really perfect balance, you know. I mean, I don't quite understand it myself. It was a surprise, but you know, finally some of these draft picks that, you know, you get when you're, you know, last place every year, you know, a couple of them came home to roost. You know, Matt Wieters and of course Manny Machado and. You know, I think that McPhail, you know, Andy McPhail before he resigned and you know, made room for Duquette, you know, I mean, he made the anchor trade, which, you know, he sent Eric Bedard to the Mariners for Adam Jones, Chris Tillman, George Sherrill, who's gone now, but they traded him and, you know, got a raft of players. You know, there's a whole bunch of guys that they got just for one broken down left-handed.
But he struck out a lot of guys, so there's always that, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah.
struck out a lot of guys with a 75-mile-an-hour fastball.
Ugh.
I really feel like McPhail set the table. Then he left, and it kind of confused everybody. People thought, like, what does he want to be, the commissioner or something? And I think
he did. That's right. There was all this talk about him going to work for the MLB, right? Okay, yeah.
And I forget what he's doing now. I'm not sure.
He's the president of the Phillies.
Oh, of course. Right.
But I think he's got a GM under him, and so I guess his ambitions to be high up in the league. When Manfred got the job, perhaps he realized he better go find a job somewhere else.
Yeah, well, it was that weird competitive. I mean, like, you know, it was like one of those. It was like an old time, like, you know, Democratic convention or Republican convention, right, or something, when they have like all kinds of like, we have to have another, you know, back room, smoke filled room vote, you know, and
the party bosses have to come to a consensus, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so I think he got sort of shoved out in all of that, you know. It was the politics of that were so ugly. But anyway, I mean, I think he did great things for the Orioles. And
was Wieters significant? And I ask this is another sort of question that ties back to my own experiences, but the end of the terrible Pirates front office, the Dave Littlefield regime that was around from 2001 to 2007, that really kind of just buried the Pirates and took this losing streak to heights that we never expected it to go to, was that he passed on Matt Wieters, who was, you know, probably the best hitting, reminding you that the draft spending at the time was very different. There was really no cap on it, but passed on Wieters to draft a college pitcher who was close to the majors, but whose ceiling was really as a reliever, and then spent the money that might have gone to Wieters on signing the carcass of Matt Morris. I mean, really, like, you talk about weird stuff. But I know that Wieters was considered to have a high price tag coming out of the draft, and so kind of given the Orioles' financial wherewithal at the time, was it surprising that they picked him? Was it something that you expected? Was it good? I mean, I'm sure it was good,
there was a ton of pressure from from the Baltimore Sun and, you know, other media outlets to sign Matt Wieters, to draft him and sign him and be done with it, because you remember as a Pittsburgh fan the almost bizarre hype around Wieters. Like, it's not hyperbolic to say that people actually said this is the best position player prospect that we've seen since World War II. Like, seriously, they did.
I mean, God. Yeah, and a catcher, no less. I mean, you know, the one
switch
position
hitting catcher who was also a closer at Georgia Tech. You know what I mean?
Right.
He would catch eight innings, and then they'd toss him the ball. He'd take his gear off and go out and be the closer.
It's like Roy Hobbs right there, you know? Like, yeah. It's just unbelievable. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So I am. So yeah, it was, you know, everybody was just, because he was a power hitter, he was a line drive hitter, he had everything. The guy, you know, he was just going to be, you know, the savior. And of course, he hasn't been. You know, he's been good. He's been a very fine all-star catcher, but, you know, he's fallen way short of the hype. And, you know, how could you imagine that anybody would ever be that good, you know?
So here's my funny story, and this is kind of what I've started to take away from the draft and immediate reactions to especially the MLB draft, is that so the Pirates pass on Wieters in 2007 to draft this pitcher that they went on the cheap for, and everyone, you know, crucifies the front office. They basically get fired from the fallout of this. It's becomes a big issue, you know, the new ownership and the new front office have to want to commit money to the draft, So the next year, they have the second overall pick, and they draft a Scott Boras client at Pedro Alvarez, pay him gobs of money, do the right thing, do the thing that everybody wants them to do. And we all know that Wieters is, despite all the hype, becomes a who they passed on the year before. Becomes a fine player, but not the all world potential future Hall of Famer. So, but the next year when they did what everybody thought they should do and draft the guy and spend the money, they passed on a catcher named Buster Posey.
Oh, well, but you know, Pedro Alvarez.
Ex pirate Pedro Alvarez. But I think I kind of love that in some ways, that it just indicates how crazy this all is in prospect stuff. But
yeah, that's true. Well, I mean, oh man, Buster Posey and Matt Wieters. That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's really amazing. That's the couple tough draft years.
Right, so Wieters is back though, right? Let's shift this a little bit to this current offseason. That wasn't really necessarily expected, right? There was, my understanding at least from some of the Orioles fans I know, is that it was kind of assumed all along that he was definitely going to be gone this offseason.
I didn't think he was going to – I wasn't going to say definite, because the only reason I thought he would be gone was because nobody else has ever accepted a qualifying offer.
Right.
I think Colby Rasmus accepted one like a couple days before Wieters did. But they made Wieters a qualifying offer, and it's like the greatest thing that ever happened to him. You know, he's coming off Tommy John surgery for a catcher, which is pretty weird. Peter Gammons wrote a fascinating piece last summer about what's it going to mean when catchers come back from Tommy John surgery, because it's so unusual. But, you know, all the wear and tear that Wieters put on his arm as a closer at Georgia Tech and as a catcher for all these years, you know, who knows how he's going to recover and if he'll ever be the same, you know. So he was
controlling the running game. I know he's considered a pretty good defensive catcher. Was that part of it? Was he pretty good? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, he was among the best. Just a real accurate, quick release. For as big a guy as he is, as tall a guy as he is, he had really quick feet and could just fire to second base in an instant. Mostly it was just sheer muscle. You know what I mean? It wasn't so much technique, though. It was just like that man can just throw a aspirin to second base.
Yeah,
and put it right on the tag. But Tommy John surgery does an awful lot to you. So I think probably those mechanics and stuff just like messed up his arm. It of course affected his offense. You know, I mean, all kinds of the injuries that he's had. He's just had a couple of bad years in a row. Wieters missed the better part of two seasons, and so yeah, I think he's still going to be a fine catcher, and certainly a lot of potential to be a really terrific switch hitting major leaguer, but. I don't know. I mean, I think he's pretty lucky to have gotten I forget what the qualifying offer was this year. I mean, it's 15 something maybe.
Right. Yeah. Like a 1 year, 15 point something million dollar deal, which.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that gives him, the only inkling I had that he would not return was that no one that had ever accepted a qualifying offer ever. But I kind of did think, you know, Matt Wieters would be insane to take himself out to the open market, because nobody's paying him $15 million this year.
Especially if it costs a draft pick too, right?
Draft pick. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So I want to speak even more broadly then kind of about where I perceive the Orioles to be, and you can agree or disagree with that, and then maybe get your thoughts on what tact you would like to see them take this offseason. I mean, sure. I guess we're still into it. So my impression is that they have a lot of really good core guys, Hardy, Jones, Machado is younger than those guys, Wieters, Tillman, who are, you know, really kind of back end of their primes, let's say, nearing kind of the when you might expect to see them decline a little bit, and they're very good, but that the pieces around them aren't necessarily quite enough to bridge the gap between what those guys provide and the best teams in the league. I mean, I guess the AL East, for all that we talked about it being a superpower in the mid-2000s, is kind of not as strong as it was. But are they kind of caught in between right now? Is it the kind of thing where there could be the real risk that you know, they could go out and win 83 games again, but they need to commit more to bringing players in if they want to challenge for a division. Or it might make some sense to start thinking about maybe trading off some of these veteran pieces before they really lose all their value, and kind of using that to build towards a more competitive team.
I think they are in the in between, and I think that they learn. I think the front office, I think Duquette and company learned a very difficult lesson last year when they didn't re-sign Nelson Cruz. Nelson Cruz provided, obviously, ridiculous power, and the year that season, I guess it was the 2014 season, was just about the most magical season that the Orioles have seen in a lot of years. And I mean, the city was electric, the ballpark was electric, and so much of it had to do with the power that they, they were just a crazy power hitting team. And you couldn't pitch around anybody. They all had double digit homers. But they let Cruz go. They didn't re-sign him, and they thought that guys like Travis Snyder could
I got some bad news for you. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, they kept Delmon Young. They got rid of. I think they cut Delmon Young first, right?
Right.
Had this weird revolving door in right field, actually in both corner outfield positions. So the Orioles just started cutting guys. They bring him in, try him out basically, and then cut him. And so, Travis Snyder, they brought Nolan Reimold back despite, Reimold's, weird injury history. They cut Delmon Young. That was a real surprise because Young, Young in 2014 had a tremendous year off the bench.
All his, status as a failed prospect and kind of a joke for what he became as a player, that was a good role for him, if I'm remembering correctly, that he really kind of found a niche as a good bat off the bench.
He did, and inexplicably, the clubhouse guys loved him. He was a good teammate. He was a terrible interview, but he was a really good teammate.
Often those two can be related, I've found. So, yeah.
Alejandro Diaz is another guy that they had and just cut out of nowhere in the middle of the year. So they just had this like weird thing where they were, trying to find the next Nelson Cruz, and suddenly I guess they realized, oh wait, he plays for Seattle now. And I think they really and that of course also they let Nick Markakis go, who was a big fan favorite. Markakis didn't set the world on fire in Atlanta, but I think a lot of people thought Alejandro Diaz is exactly the same as Markakis, and I don't know. There just was a big hole in the lineup that Buck Showalter couldn't fill, and I think that what you see now in the winter meetings and the talk of some of the guys that the Orioles are interested in, including keeping Chris Davis.
Yeah, which again, another one that I thought maybe was a foregone conclusion that he was going to go. But I really feel like I've seen the Orioles linked to a lot of the names on them. I think Giovanni Gallardo is another one, and they seem to be very serious about Davis. So it seems like they're really more active than I anticipated they might be, or that I understood they might be.
I agree, and I mean about Davis, I don't know. $150 million over 7 years, I think. Andy, what do you think the over-under is on 1,800 strikeouts in 7 years?
I think I'll probably take the over if it offered it. Especially, in years 5, 6, and 7, if he's – I guess the under would be that he's just a part-time player by that point or something.
He'd get enough APs to strike out that many times. Yeah, I don't know. I think that's paying an awful lot of money for the guy. If they get him, I'm going to be happy. But on the other hand, I think, if he decides to take, more than $150 million. It's been said he's looking for $200 million in 8 years, which is, obscene.
It's almost like if it goes that high, I as a fan would be like, good luck elsewhere. We'll figure something out first.
Good luck elsewhere as long as it is in Boston.
Yeah, right.
That's what I'm afraid of, but... But yeah, I don't know.
I'd appreciate it if it was in St. Louis too. If you could somehow make that happen.
Well, that, see, that's
I like, know. Yeah,
he is talking. I think Scott Boras is talking to the Cardinals.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, but I think that they are. I mean, I think that they learned. They really did seem to learn a lesson, and they are attached to some, you know, some pretty big names. I mean, they talked to Justin Upton the other day, and you know.
At least trying to make the most, it seems, of whatever, you know, this core of really good. There's the real startings of what could be a very contending core, it seems like. And I do gather that they kind of are trying to make the most of it or maximize what's kind of left of the primes of some of these guys that we were talking about. So that's,
yeah, I think so. And yeah. I mean, you mentioned Gallardo. I don't think that's going to happen because I think Gallardo wants 4 years. And you know that what the Orioles just had. I mean, the last time they did that was with Ubaldo Jimenez.
they went 1-for-2 in those signings, right? That was like Jimenez and Cruz, and they really nailed it with Nelson Cruz and Ubaldo, and not so much. But
well, yeah, I mean, you're right. Yeah, I still like Ubaldo. I think, you know, when he gets it right, he's really good. But you know, I mean, they left him off the playoff roster, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, yeah, that's not what you want from the guy you just signed for 4 years. You
right. So, all right. So I guess to even just kind of wrap up here, what would be a satisfying season for you in 2016 as an Orioles fan? Is there a record you want? Is there a general, I don't know, level of success that would appeal?
I mean, after so many years of losing, you know, and so many years of just massive suction, you know, what has felt really nice to me, and like I said, 2014 was absolute magic, and I was in the ballpark for a lot of those really exciting wins, and you know, I mean, it's really great. But you know, if you can just be in the race, if you can be in the race until the end of it, that's just about enough. You know what I mean? I want to win the World Series desperately. And when the Orioles are in the playoffs, it's like, oh, my God, I can hardly stand it. You know what I mean? Like
I have in the last couple of years, just sometimes shorter than others, when you give up a grand slam in the second inning of an elimination game, it's a little bit. It's over pretty quickly. But been reminded of just baseball tension and the tension of rooting for your team in the baseball playoffs is like unlike anything else. Like it is its own unique brand of scary and awesome and thrilling and all those things.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I was fine in my – I mean, I'm obsessed, you know, at the end of the season and then during the playoffs, if the Orioles are in the postseason, I can't think about anything else. Like, at work, I'm walking around, that's all I'm thinking about. It's like, this is really weird.
How can you send me this email? Chris Davis may have just been suspended. Like, you know, it's like all that stuff. It's like, sorry to bring that. I didn't mean to take that.
Oh, you did. Point.
Yeah,
you did,
I know. That
you're
was
the one. You told me that.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Well, anyway, I'm happy if they're in it. I really, really want to see them. It was no fun. I shouldn't say it was no fun because it's always fun being a fan, but it's so much fun to win, to hang around in the race and be competitive.
I have this theory, and it sounds like I'm glad to hear you say it because it sounds like you kind of agree with me at least. But I think that what we really want as fans is just the belief for however many days throughout the season that your team could win a championship.
Yep, that's it. You said it.
Yeah. Yep. So awesome. Well, Smitty, thank you so much for being the inaugural Spitter podcast guest. This was
Andy. I can't thank you enough
a blast.
For doing it.
Yeah. So people can check out the site. It'll be thespitter.com coming very, very soon. And we look forward to more podcasts. And we'll talk to you all soon.